This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Presidents Obama and Putin voice conflicting views over Syria at the UN General Assembly. A big discovery on Mars. Something new coming out of vending machines.
Kids were so excited because they could really touch and pick a book that was important to them. So nobody, no adult was telling them what book they had to take. The kids have an opportunity to select a book and then they can keep them.
A top female blues singer really belts it out. These and other stories just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Presidents Obama and Vladimir Putin of Russia are at odds over how to end about 5 years of fighting in Syria. There was a clash of views at the UN General Assembly meeting in New York Monday, Mr. Obama telling the gathering that after so much bloodshed and carnage, Syria cannot return to a pre-war status quo. But President Putin, making his first UN speech in a decade, warned that it would be an enormous mistake to not cooperate with the Assad government in fighting Islamic State insurgents who are trying to oust the Syrian leader. UN correspondent Margaret Bashir talked about that and more with International Edition's Jim Stevenson, beginning with President Obama's remarks.
He sort of was a part lecture about diplomacy and international cooperation and part pep talk on the UN 70th anniversary about the importance of international order. And he said, we all have a stake in each other's success. No country can solve all the world's problems alone. And we must work effectively together or we'll all suffer the consequences. And he was quite clear in saying the United States cannot do everything on its own. And he pointed out that strength, a nation's strength, comes not necessarily from its military power, but from its people, and they need to be free to thrive and to be creative.
The president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, of course, is there, and all eyes on him after there have been some military movements in and around Syria. What did he have to say?
Well, he was pretty anticipated what he would say. It was no big surprise. I mean, there were certainly direct and indirect references to Russia and Mr. Putin and Mr. Obama's speech, and the United States is very unhappy about the annexation of Crimea, and Mr. Obama spoke about powers that assert themselves in ways that contravene international law, and so Mr. Putin sort of had his little bit of a rebuttal, and he spoke about sovereignty being about freedom and the right to a future, and, you know, just he sort of refuted some of the things that Mr. Obama said and spoke about other countries that interfere on pretexts of things. So you could see he was not happy with Mr. Obama.
Of course, Iran is another hot topic. I'm sure there has been some discussion.
Yes, the Iranian president spoke a lot about the Iran nuclear deal that was agreed in July in Vienna with the six major powers. And he said although Iran did not like sanctions, they thought they were illegal when they were imposed on them, that they wouldn't dwell on that and they would move forward now and that this is a new chapter. And he focused on the idea that Iran wants to have economic relations with other countries, that they want to be developed, that they want to become a hub for export-oriented investment. And he said that Iran is eager to show that they can choose a lasting peace based on development and shared interests rather than a volatile peace based on threats.
We, of course, have many world leaders who speak at this annual event. What were some of the other highlights that you heard?
Well, Chinese President Xi spoke, and he pledged $1 billion in aid to the UN Peace and Development Fund, and he promised to create a reserve force of 8,000 UN peacekeeping troops. He also announced China would give $100 million in military assistance to the African Union over the next 5 years to fight terrorism.
UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. And now a look at how the online crowd is reacting to the UN General Assembly meeting in New York. Here's our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray.
Let's begin with a good handle to follow. What do you have?
Ray, for most UN events, the UNSG spokesperson's account is my go-to handle. And by UNSG, I mean UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. That spokesperson's official Twitter account is @UN_spokesperson.
All right, I see that. So tell us about a tweet from that account.
So the account sent out multiple quotes by Mr. Pan during the summit, but let's just read one as an example. Demand for at UN peacekeeping has never been greater. Pan Ki-moon says we must reinvigorate peace operations, hashtag PK Summit. That quote has been retweeted more than 100 times, and hashtag PK Summit refers to peacekeeping summit.
So what about at UN peacekeeping? Mm-hmm. That should be a good one to follow.
Absolutely. That's the official Twitter account of the United Nations peacekeeping. It's been sending a tweet every few minutes Monday, and the tweets are about which country is pledging to do what to contribute to the UN peacekeeping efforts. What's interesting is that these tweets are in multiple languages, although most of them are in English.
And what about Washington's pledge? Anything there?
Well, basically to double its efforts. So President Obama said Washington will work to double the number of U.S. military officers in U.N. peacekeeping operations in addition to other expansions. And this is what the U.S. State Department tweeted. At PK Summit, POTUS announced expanded U.S. support for U.N. peacekeeping operations. It also added a video clip of the president's remarks. The State Department is on Twitter at StateDEPT. Now, other pledges are more specific. Rwanda, for example, pledged 2 helicopters, a hospital, an all-female police unit, and 1,600 troops. Ray?
Thanks. Social media reporter G. Abby Lee. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's J-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Global markets have seen better days. A long-running sell-off continues. VOA business correspondent Alexis Christophorus joins us from our New York bureau.
U.S. stocks closed sharply lower as uncertainty about the timing of a rate hike and concerns about global economic growth continue to weigh on sentiment. The S&P 500 closed down about 2.5%, falling below the psychologically key level of 1900 for the first time since late August. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed near session lows, off about 300 points, but holding just above that psychologically important 16,000 level. The Dow and S&P are now on track for their worst quarter in 4 years. Shares of Apple closed nearly 2% lower despite news it sold more than 13 million units of the new iPhone 6S and 6S Plus models in a record first weekend of sales. The next big catalyst for global markets will be the September unemployment report in the U.S. due out on Friday.
Christophorus also says China's sluggish economy is forcing some e-commerce giants to target new customers.
So players like Alibaba and JD.com are now focusing on expanding their user bases to rural regions. The objective here is to reach out to the untouched user base in those rural areas and to boost the online sales, which in turn will, of course, generate more revenue. According to a report from the China Internet Network Information Center, the number of internet users in China reached 668 million in June of this year. This accounts for nearly 49% of China's total population. The internet penetration rate in urban areas is around 64%, whereas the penetration rate in the rural region is only 30%. Last year, many villages in China were introduced to internet-enabled smartphones thanks to government programs, and many consumers had their first experience with online shopping. The number of online shoppers grew at a rate of 41% in rural regions. Those figures clearly suggest a strong potential for increased online shopping in rural regions of China. E-commerce players like Alibaba, JD.com, Tencent Holdings, and Baidu are stepping up their game and trying to expand their logistics network to these rural regions.
Business correspondent Alexis Christophorus in New York. NASA Space Agency scientists have found strong evidence of saltwater streams on Mars, at least during the Red Planet's summer. Scientists are calling it a major find in the exploration of Mars. VOA's Victoria Maki talked about Monday's announcement with International Edition host Susan Yaki.
What NASA's telling us is that they've found what they're calling recurring slope lineae. Now, really what this means is that they've got really strong evidence, from what they're saying, that there is some sort of water flow on Mars. Now, before NASA knew that there was frozen water on Mars, but this shows that there could actually be what they say is very salty, briny water actually flowing, perhaps during summer, on the planet.
But not actually like a creek or anything, more like a salt flow, a wet salt flow.
Right, correct. Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, they've repeated it every single time they've answered questions about it. Very salty, lots of minerals. And it doesn't mean that they've got any indication of life so far, but this, you know, leads them to wonder, you know, could there have been and is there now anything else?
Yeah, it opens up the possibility that maybe once upon a time there was water on there and that could have supported life. And if there is still water there, say under the surface, then that opens up the possibility of having a human activity on Mars, maybe a settlement of some sort.
Sure. And what they're saying is, you know, at least this gives them a good indication of where to look. You know, there's a few more missions planned between now and, you know, 2020. So this really kind of points them in the right direction for where they can start searching, you know, on the ground Mars for forms of life.
This takes baby steps to find out anything. It's so far away, people don't realize how difficult it is to even find this much.
Right. And I mean, they're really planning. I mean, the planning for these scientists is years and decades down the line. I mean, it moves incrementally, slowly. But these guys, you see them right now, they're so, so excited about this finding. I mean, they're just overjoyed with just this little bit of new knowledge.
VOA reporter Victoria Maki speaking with my colleague Susan Yaki. NASA has found evidence of water on Mars in the past. In March, the U.S. Space Agency said there was once more water on Mars than in Earth's Arctic Ocean. Voters in the northeastern Spanish region of Catalonia Sunday gave the pro-secessionist group Together for Yes group 48% of the vote in parliamentary elections, a boost to those wishing to break away from Spain, although it's not a majority in their bid to seek eventual independence. If they are able to form a coalition with the leftist pro-independence Popular Unity Candidacy Party, they will command a slight majority of seats in the 135-seat regional parliament. Atlantic Council Spain analyst Carlos Castillo told International Edition's Victor Beatty it may be impossible for the two parties to form a coalition.
The two pro-independence parties are very, very different from each other. Together for Yes, it's union of social movement, conservative party, and the Republican left. And then the other party who took 10 seats, it's extreme left. And they are like anti-capitalism, anti a lot of things that are not going to stand well with the rest of the parties.
So it's not altogether a foregone conclusion that they will actually try to form a unity government.
Correct. Extreme left has already said that they are not going to vote for the current president, Artur Mas. They say that he has used these elections also to cover some corruption scandals. And because of Artur Mas being on the conservative side of the spectrum, he had also been very tough on cuts on the social welfare budget, health, public education budget. So the extreme left is not happy with that. They said that Artur Mas probably is not going to be invested president. So we have a very tricky situation here where we can have different scenarios with Together for Yes deciding to just form a minority government or trying to coalesce with extreme left, but with a different candidate altogether.
Why do they want independence? And did the Scottish referendum have any impact on their plans?
The problem is that, and I know it's a technicality, but this was not a referendum, right? This was a regional election. So technically, the things that were counted were seats, were not total votes. The total vote was won by the people against independence. So there's been a 52-53% of the vote, which were people saying no to independence. So now we have a situation in which the popular vote has said no. The seats won by the pro-independence is a yes, it's an absolute majority. And so I think the central government will have to think through the situation, sit down, and try to negotiate. An additional layer of issues here is that we have general elections in Spain in December. So I'm not sure a lot will move until then. I think everyone's kind of waiting and seeing what's going to happen in the general election to then open a new phase in this whole conflict.
Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy's ruling Popular Party government says it will use all legal means to prevent Catalonia from breaking away. But what does that mean?
The Popular Party did something that also upset a lot of Democrats in Spain, including the Socialist Party, including a lot of others. They just did an express reform of the Constitutional Court, something that hadn't been done in 30 years of democracy. They decided to give the court the power to actually prevent Artur Mas from declaring independence and basically like intervening in the region if it's needed, which basically alters the balance between powers. All of a sudden, you have a Constitutional Court who's going to be able to decide when a president is fit or not to rule a region, which is a total flip of the argument, right? So really, he cannot do much.
That's Atlantic Council Spain analyst Carlos Castillo talking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Still to come, free books for children. This is VOA.
This is Greenbee for a healthier planet.
Researchers in Australia are working on a robot that could help protect the Great Barrier Reef from the predatory crown of thorns starfish called COTS. The underwater robot, the COTSBot, has been 10 years in the making. Matt Dunbabin is with the Queensland University of Technology.
It's only still basically this year that we've been able to really hit it hard and come up with a solution that we think can really make a difference.
For now, divers hunt out the predators and inject them with a toxic solution. But Dunbabin says they are just not enough people to do the job.
We need a force multiplier that is actually going to make a difference on the reef.
Researchers say they hope the COTSBot will be fully functional by early 2016 to seek and destroy the invasive starfish, delivering more than 200 lethal shots in 8 hours' time. The robot has been trained to pick out the pests from other sea life through the use of film and 3D printed models. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Greenbeat.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. A new study by the International Labor Organization finds more than half of all people 65 years and older have no access to urgently needed long-term care. The study finds an alarming lack of social protection for the aging population and a global shortfall of 13.6 million workers to care for its needs. Lisa Schlein has details.
The study of 46 countries covers 80% of the world population aged 65 and over. The report says 300 million elderly people are incapacitated in various ways. Many have lost their mobility and cannot walk. Some may have mental illnesses such as Alzheimer's, while others may need daily assistance to tend to their basic health needs. ILO Health Policy Coordinator and author of the study, Shenya Shale Adlung, says the whole long-term care issue is largely neglected due to both age and gender discrimination.
This age discrimination and gender discrimination, but particularly age discrimination, is publicly not considered as a serious concern. Other than other forms of discrimination, we find that it is largely accepted that, for example, older people get less services, they are expected to consume less public funds. But if we compare rehabilitation services, which are needed both by younger and older persons, we find that older persons get much less.
The report says in Africa, which lacks 1.5 million long-term care workers, more than 90% of older persons do not receive care. It says the need for long-term health care workers in absolute numbers is greatest in Asia and the Pacific. It says this region lacks 8.2 million workers, depriving 65% of the over 65 population of assistance. Older people generally do better in Europe, but the report notes even European countries spend on average only 2% or less of their gross domestic product on long-term care for the elderly. Due to the shortage of health care workers, the International Labour Organization says unpaid female family members end up caring for up to 80% of all older people in need of assistance. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And we go from the oldsters to the youngsters. Children are used to using vending machines to buy snacks and drinks. But here in Washington, some children are now able to go to a vending machine to get books for free. The Book Vending Machine Program is the first of its kind in the United States, part of a literacy initiative started 5 years ago by JetBlue Airlines. Faith Lapidus has more.
Dozens of books that appeal to children are within reach at the push of a button. Stories about dinosaurs, elephants, knights, robots, and lots of other things. And the young readers get a lot of encouragement.
Everybody raise your hand and say, I promise to read every single day.
Isma Gibbs is taking part in a book reading event, and kids gather around to listen and interact.
Ladybugs are dancing on tippity feet. Tippity, tippity. Happy feet. Who has happy feet?
Me.
Me too.
After story time, the kids go to the book vending machine. They make their choice, and the book tumbles down from the machine's coils. The Book Vending Machine Program is sponsored by JetBlue Airlines. Gibbs is the company's director of corporate social responsibility.
We know that reading is important. We understand the importance of reading for our pilots and our flight attendants and everybody that works at JetBlue. And so making sure that kids develop a lifelong love of reading when they're really young is important to us. And we figure that that helps us have better future crew members or people to work for us.
Not only are these books free, the children may keep them.
Our program is based on trying to get books in the hands of children who don't have age-appropriate books at home. The kids were so excited because they could really touch and pick a book that was important to them. So nobody, no adult was telling them what book they had to take. The kids have an opportunity to select a book and then they can keep them.
This book vending machine, located inside a church, is one of three recently installed in Anacostia, a poor neighborhood with one of the lowest literacy rates in Washington. It is already playing a vital role here, since many parents cannot afford to buy books for their kids, says Tabika Green of the National Black Child Development Institute.
The book vending machines through the SOAR with reading program are a critical resource, and they are strategically located in places where families naturally go. So in a place of worship and at a grocery store, at the Salvation Army, where parents and families are naturally going to engage or receive services.
She says the program inspires families to make reading a regular leisure activity.
When we're differentiating between the public library and the book vending machine, I look at this as a way for families to begin building their libraries at home.
And kids seem excited about it.
Because if you don't read, you can't do stuff because you don't know. Because books tell you stuff. And if you don't read, then you don't know stuff.
Because it helps me read better when I grow up.
Tabika Green hopes the presence of the book vending machines will inspire the community to help children read more books.
Finding innovative ways to make resources available is really making the difference. You know, I consider this a game changer. I've heard stories that there are other stores that are interested in bringing the vending machines there. And so when we hear that, we know those organizations that are located in communities are trying to do a better job of being responsive to needs.
This is a pilot program, but its sponsors hope to make book vending machines a common feature in other communities where they can help boost literacy and a love of reading. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Last month, Living Blues magazine named Diuna Greenleaf top female blues artist of the year. But while the Houston, Texas-based artist is well-known in some other countries, she is still struggling to gain a large following here in the United States. Greenleaf hopes to move her career forward with some ambitious recording plans while performing whenever she can on stages big and small. Here's VOA's Greg Flakes.
Some music fans have called Dionna Greenleaf a force of nature, but she credits Texas for at least some of her bold singing style.
In Texas, you're supposed to be crisp and clear, you know what I mean, and strong.
Everybody know you've been doing wrong.
Her parents were well-known gospel singers, but they encouraged their children to explore all types of music.
We swam in an ocean of music.
Greenleaf did not become a professional singer until the late 1990s, after she had completed college and served 19 years in the U.S. Army. But her success in blues displeases some gospel fans.
Earlier this year, I was uninvited to a big church event where I was supposed to sing because I had received too much acclaim in blues.
Time keeps moving on.
She writes many of her own songs, starting by writing down thoughts when she is alone in a pensive mood.
Sometimes those thoughts come out in the form of poetry. Sometimes they come out in the form of lyrics.
She has a bunch of new songs, and she would also like to record some standards done by female singers in the 1940s and 50s.
I really have the material ready for 3 CDs, and I'd like to go ahead and do all of them back to back to back, but, you know, there's always the question of money.
In the meantime, encouraged by Living Blues magazine's recognition, Dionna Greenleaf keeps busy performing with her band Blue Mercy around the U.S. as well as in Canada and Europe. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Houston.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. More news and information at your fingertips at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The basin of the Lower Mekong River, which runs from China through Burma, Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam, and drains into the South China Sea, is home to over 60 million people. Some 85% of them rely directly on the river for their livelihoods, particularly those who are involved in irrigated agriculture and fishing. This means that any unexpected occurrence that affects the flow of the Mekong River could spell disaster for the entire region. That is why, on August 31st, USAID and NASA, in cooperation with the Asian Disaster Preparedness Center, the Deltares Institute of the Netherlands, Sweden's Stockholm Environment Institute, and the Spatial Informatics Group of California, launched the Surveyor Mekong Project, which will use satellite imagery to monitor the region's environment. The hope is that this technology will allow for more accurate prediction and management of floods, droughts, and other natural disasters, allowing regional decision makers to improve agricultural risk management, manage land use more sustainably, assess impacts of hydroelectric power facilities, and help governments and communities increase resilience to the negative effects of climate change. So, for example, satellite imaging will monitor weather patterns, water cycles, and water availability, which may be heavily impacted by climate change and by population growth. This will allow for better long-term planning, which should improve regional food security and forest resource management. On the other hand, a function called satellite remote sensing can monitor long-term changes in vegetative land cover caused by urbanization, deforestation, and agricultural practices. This data could, for example, be used to determine whether current farming practices are producing optimal crop yields. Such information will allow agronomists, urban planners, natural resource managers, and forestry personnel to make informed decisions about crops, urban development, and forest management, to name just a few. Under Sevier Mekong, we are tapping into the best available science and technology to help protect this region's vital ecosystems and the benefits they provide to society, said Beth Page, director of USAID's Regional Development Mission for Asia. Already, Asian scientists, NASA scientists, and others are beginning to develop tools to build resilience and contribute to tackling some of the region's most pressing challenges.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.